This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Australia's number one award-winning show for exploring sex, sexuality, and self.
Hide and seek.
Visit joy.org.au/hide and seek.
Hide and seek.
Good evening. Welcome to Hide and Seek. It is your show for exploring sex, sexuality and self. My name is Dean Beck. And tonight, yet again, I find myself here before you, alone. But that's okay. I've got you. So, hey, get in contact with me. What are you doing for Easter? Are you heading off to Bendigo to see the Bendigo Easter Fair? Something that I was part of for many, many years of my life. Are you going away for Easter? Are you staying in town? What are you doing for Easter? Are you getting up to naughty things? Because I certainly hope that I will be. But none of that has got anything to do with tonight's show. Although, tonight's show does have, in a strange way, a religious connotation. Yes, and not in a good way, though. You may be aware that there is a Royal Commission on regarding the institutionalised abuse of children in our community. It has been going on for some time. It has still got a lot more to uncover, sadly. But we will find out about one survivor's story. Jonathan Goodfellow will join us. He's an artist and has done a lot in the LGBTI community over the years, but he is also a survivor of child sexual abuse, and he will reveal his rather harrowing story and how he managed to get through that. So a trigger warning, if these conversations upset you, then perhaps tune out and join us again after the show. But if you want to know how one person managed to get through it all and continue to flourish, then join us when Jonathan Goodfellow shares his story. It is a remarkable tale, and honestly, I think that it is a conversation that we do not have enough in our community, and there are plenty in our community who are survivors of sexual assault. Stick with us for that. Also, get in contact with me. I'd love to hear from you. Dean Beck with you on Hide and Seek tonight, and we are very, very pleased to welcome a special guest to the program, someone who has been on one hell of a life journey. His name is Jonathan Goodfellow. Thank you very much for making yourself available tonight.
It's great to be here, Dean.
Jonathan, your journey as a gay man is has involved a lot of coming out.
Yeah,
in various matters.
It sure has. I guess there's the coming out that we all have.
We all go through that at some point in our life.
If you've gone through it, all of you out there, you really ought to if you haven't yet. But there's, of course, coming out to one's friends, families, you know, work. There's the different layers of the onion in which that can happen. For me, I had, I guess, a couple of additional coming outs.
I experienced that myself, you know, only last year in my going public about my HIV status, and that was like a second coming out. And I certainly felt that in doing it a second time, if you like, even though it was 25 years apart, some of those distinctions are equally relevant the first time round as they are the second time round.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, in some ways, I mean, you know, I guess these sorts of life experiences don't tend to happen all at once for everybody. My story's a little bit like yours. I had a coming out some 25, 30 years ago about being gay, and then more recently have come out as a survivor of child sexual abuse.
Now, that's something that we just don't talk about, and particularly as gay men, yet I know there are lots of gay men that have been survivors of sexual abuse.
Yeah, indeed, myself too. It's really remarkable when we're so sexualized as a community that indeed perhaps the way we became sexualized might be taboo in themselves, especially if they involve underage sex being your first experience and unconsenting, non-consenting sex.
Which is very different. I mean, I've spoken publicly about my first sexual experience being as a five-year-old and, you know, my doing beats from the age of about 11.
Yep.
But none of that was non-consensual, and none of it I have ever considered to be anything other than me exploring my own sexual self.
Yes.
It's very different for a child who is under the influence of a power game.
Yeah, yeah, indeed, that's right. For me, my first encounters with sex, I mean, apart from the natural things that a you know,
kids
young
do.
Person up until, you know, they're five, seven, however old, I mean, you, for you, your first play was around five. You're pushing the boundaries there, Dean. But
so I keep getting told, but, you know.
my first experience with sex was at the age of seven with a member of the clergy. And
right.
I experienced that abuse for about 2-3 years. So under the age of 10 was when it stopped. And as I said, you know, I came out very young. I didn't realise at the time why I was so hypersexualised, but that's what it had done to me. And I guess for many years, despite coming out young and being very sexualised, I never admitted to myself that this abuse had occurred. In fact, it was the deepest secret I really kept hidden in my life.
So how did that play out? How did hiding all of that and not being able to in any way express it other than perhaps the hypersexualised nature of your being,
yes,
which, you know, feeds into that.
Yes.
How
yes.
else did it play out?
Well, it played out in, well, I guess another layer of the onion, that is mental health difficulties. I came from a family which was dysfunctional, a father who experienced, you know, alcoholism and himself was very physically abusive. And at a young age, I began expressing interest in things outside the home in order to get me away from that situation. So, you know, there's another two layers there. It's just we've got domestic violence and we've got mental health. But once I was an adult, every few years, I mean, between, say, 5 and 10 years at a time, I would experience breakdowns. I'd been through a hell of a lot of therapy and thought, what have I done wrong? I've failed at this therapy. I'm not getting over it.
So that tells me a few things. It tells me that there's a merry-go-round that you're on, that for some reason you're not breaking that cycle, and that when it comes around, it's there before you know it.
Yeah.
But how did that sort of manifest? What were the elements within that that were triggers and that sort of thing?
Really, some of the classic post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. So, I mean, one good thing that happened in my experience was that at a relatively young age, in 97, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, which, look, labels can do some people a great deal of good and help them get to a point of recovery. For other people, they might not be so useful. But for me, it was helpful to know that I'd been traumatised, and that was really looking at my father and his violence.
Right.
So it didn't deal with the child sexual abuse issue. And in fact, look, you know, I've got to throw my arms up in celebration of Julia Gillard. She's really the only political leader we've had in the last, well, in the last, in living memory, who actually has had no links to the church and therefore was in a position to call the Royal Commission. And I really doubt that we'd be where we are today without that happening. Of course, that was the prompt that brought me to come out.
Yeah, and you say that this investigation into institutionalised sex abuse was the catalyst. But again, I can see that there was an element of the merry-go-round that you were still on. And whilst that might have been the breaking point in that merry-go-round, what was it that was manifesting yet again? And
yes,
how was it looking? How did that look to you?
Look, it was feeling like a very fragile, vulnerable person,
right.
A person who, because of that vulnerability, became quite ensconced in my own home environment, quite agoraphobic from time to time, so at times unable to leave the house.
You've had a fairly successful community-based career, though, which is about getting out there and being at the forefront of, you know, a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and I think you could probably tell from the discussion we're having, I'm not a person who's shy about coming forward about things. So, look, it really does demonstrate that anybody can be struck by mental illness. Now, of course, mine was about historical events, but it really does underline that we are all vulnerable to mental health issues. So the other things I experienced were the classic night terrors, the dreams of the harrowing dreams of reliving the events, or or certainly having the people involved in the events in my dreams consistently. You know, develop a fear of sleep, for example, just because of those terrifying dreams. So we don't yet have a successful treatment to not necessarily stop the dreams, but stop you remembering the dreams.
Was there a time where all of that didn't exist? You'd blocked it out to a point where it was not even in your conscience? It had just it just didn't ever exist?
Yeah. I'd say really up until the point that the Royal Commission was called. I mean, really right throughout my life, I continued to bury it deep.
And perhaps blame the incidents with your father and his behaviour that was the cause of much of your angst.
Yeah, certainly that was one element of it. I think the other element of it, and this is common again for people who have experienced sexual abuse at any age, but particularly as children, I blame myself. I saw it bound up in my issues of sexual identity. Mm. I saw it bound up in the fact that I was over-sexualised as a teenager and through much of my adult life.
That's an interesting term, because I always get a little bit funny about that term, over-sexualised, and that...
Yes, me too.
According to whom?
Exactly.
You know?
Yes. So, well, you can imagine that as an openly gay man who's talking quite frankly with you, when I'm talking about over-sexualised, I'm talking about to the point where it really interferes with my day-to-day life.
Sure.
And a lot of that had gone on, and I had been searching for validation through sex, and those issues weren't related to my father. They were related to the abuse and me questioning my sexuality. Was it as a result of my experiences, etc., etc.? Of course, all of that's behind me. All of that work, if you like, was dealt with when I came out. But this deeper knowledge that I'd been manipulated and that I was, weak and vulnerable in relation to my sexual identity because of the abuse, is not something that really came to the fore until the Royal Commission was called, and we had, everyday news pieces about, the most heinous of crimes. And the more I looked into it, then I found that, in fact, the member of the clergy that I had been sexually abused by had abused other young people. These were questions I had long burnt into my mind. The rectory was set up somewhat like a dorm. On any weekend, there could be a dozen or more young people staying there. As the evening, started to come on, the early evening, these young children would be going to bed screaming, sort of calling out to the priest to give them affection. So everybody that was already there at that rectory was incredibly vulnerable. And so these images returned to me as well, these images of what that actual place was like, what had happened to these other children, where could I get answers about this? And after that, I received legal advice about putting my statement together from No More Legal Services in Perth. The abuse happened to me as a child in Perth. I won't mention the church or anything. I won't mention denomination. I'm still discussing with the church, receiving some, recognition or compensation of my ordeal. So at this point, I'm not keen to talk about the actual people concerned. The other thing about that is the individual who was the perpetrator in my case and a number of other cases, somewhat of a cluster, actually committed suicide in 1994. So, I'm obviously discussing, my, if you like, future with the diocese that that individual was with.
I think you've given us a few hints there nonetheless. Jonathan Goodfellow is our guest on Hide and Seek tonight. We're talking about, ultimately, his journey of survival as a victim of child sexual abuse. It's not an easy conversation to have, but it's one that, sadly, we actually need to have more of, I think.
Yeah, I think we do too. There's There's not many gay men I know, well, whilst I've had many tell me about their experience of abuse. And of course, that would include them as adults. They've not consented to sexual acts with other men whom, you know, they may have consented to originally. But, you know, putting aside all of that, there isn't a movement really in Australia that's at all discernible of gay men coming out about their abuse and seeking support through their peers.
Do you think that's partly because, well, it's multifaceted, I know, but particularly, let's take the Catholic Church as an example, where homosexuality is demonised to such an extent that it in itself is wrong. So if you're then gay,
yes,
and you've been a part of what is deemed by some as a homosexual act, I mean, it was certainly between two males,
yes.
Whether you define that as a homosexual act or one of, you know, rape, ultimately, then it's confused in that mix. And therefore, I guess it questions one's sense of self as a gay man.
Yes, that's very true. You know, it's also something that you don't want to define you for the rest of, of your time, if you like. It's something in a sense that I think could and can and should be approached with a sense that you can recover. A lot of people may not agree. There are really varying views on this as to whether traumatic events are something you can actually accept into yourself without there being any ongoing symptoms, or whether you kind of really need to purge it. You know, for me, talking about it, and I guess my art has been the other catalyst, has put me in an opportunity where I'm talking about it a lot to a lot of people.
Is that helping?
And I do think it's helping. Obviously, I'm having sessions with psychologists, etc., and I would always recommend that people, you know, regardless of whether they're, you know, going to art therapy or looking at any kind of therapy, that they do so in a very holistic way. Yeah. Make sure you've got your GPs and a psychologist or a professional counsellor involved.
And a few backstops if you need them.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, people can, if they know about these things, plan a little for them, you know, use a bit of their leave to look at some of these issues, etc. But essentially, I recommend people do get support mechanisms in place and try to talk about it a little. For me, I've ended up talking about that publicly. For others, they're obviously perhaps not going to do that. But why I'm doing that is because we need more gay men to speak out about their experience publicly. Mm. We need to also be breaking this, you know, heinous association that the church, as you say, and along with many of its contemporaries, if it remained a historic view, well, all well and good. But the relationship between pedophilia and homosexuality is one that the, you know, the myth and the lies continue to be spread out there about. And I think as a survivor, I've also got a role there to say, I was abused. I'm not somebody who perpetrates abuse.
You know, it's one of the most, I think, revolting aspects of this whole conversation is the church has then used that interaction between two males as being the demonising element of homosexuality. And it's got nothing to do with it.
Yes, yes. It was just shocking, and I'm sure many others were shocked to watch Cardinal Pell's evidence. And I mean, I've watched a lot of the evidence for a lot of the witnesses that have gone before the commission. It's been something of a fascination. I think I'll write about it one day with any hope. But really, to see Cardinal Pell talk about it being a time in which, you know, if sexual abuse was a crime that was involved with a particular a priest, then it wouldn't be raised at meetings where their futures would be discussed. That was the culture of the day. He also confirmed that there was a culture that said if the person was pubescent, then that was considered an act of homosexuality as opposed to an act of child sex abuse. Now, of course, nobody else in society makes that delineation.
It's bizarre.
It's really about, well, it's about consent, isn't it, again?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, the law says in most states in Australia you need to be 16 to be having sex with somebody 1 or 2 years older than you. And clearly none of this activity fits into that
definition.
Well,
they say that now. They didn't say that back then.
Yes, yes. And that's the thing, you know, it's a great distortion of the truth. I mean, look, if you're in a situation like that where you're in a decision-making scenario and you know something isn't being said, you would ask the question. I don't care when it was.
Jonathan Goodfellow is our guest on Hide and Seek tonight, and if any of this is raising issues for you personally, Lifeline is there for you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. 13 11 14 is their number. Do not hesitate to give them a call, 13 11 14. And of course, our very own Switchboard telephone counselling service is available 7 days a week from 3 p.m. to 12 midnight. And their number is 1-800-184-527, 1-800-184-527. Or you can chat to someone on their web chat service at qlife.org.au. Dean Beck with you on Hide and Seek tonight. We'll have a chat to Jonathan Goodfellow about his art right after this on Hide and Seek.
Joy 94.9.
Dean Beck flying solo on Hide and Seek tonight. The boys have got another night off, but my guest is Jonathan Goodfellow, who is an artist, a photographer. He's done lots of things in the community, but he's here tonight to talk about his special journey as a survivor of child sexual abuse. It was brought to the fore by the Royal Commission into Institutionalised Responses to Child Sex Abuse, and since then he's been working very hard to understand what it was that took place in his own life and share that with others so that he may help them in their own journey. Jonathan, why have this conversation today? Why come forward and be that voice?
It's a good question. I mean, it's a very individual, I guess, thing to do. My art, I think, is something that I don't really have a lot of control over in my life. In some ways, you could really say that it's the most unwielding force in my life. And it just happens to be the fact that as I've given evidence to the commission, I've really come back out of my shell as a fine artist and have been really entirely... I guess artists might know what I'm talking about, in the zone. That time, it's really helped me be back in touch.
So how does it, in a therapeutic sense, assist you? I mean, I can only imagine that as you were preparing papers for the Royal Commission, that would have brought everything to a head and been a pretty tough time.
Yeah, it has been a very difficult time. We talked a bit earlier about the symptoms that can come out when you experience PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder, and all of those were live and really affecting me on a day-to-day basis. I have good medical support, that's obviously one thing, but what the art does is, and it surprised me in what it's done, it takes me to a place where time really has very little meaning. I'm very much working in the moment, which is what you'll find a lot of counsellors, a lot of meditation practice is focused on. There are a lot of synergies indeed between the process of getting into focus with your own psyche and working on art that is, you are letting rather express those things.
It's
from
interesting.
Inside.
Last night on Catalyst, there was a special about pain management.
Yep.
And there was evidence to suggest that by being in the moment as an by doing something you love, whether it's gardening or doing painting or something like that, that for people with chronic pain, it lessened greatly when they were doing something that they loved and were in that moment. It makes sense.
Yeah, and I think it's still one of the great unexplored, or, you know, a lot of things have gone mainstream in the last decade, I'm sure you'd agree. Even the act of participating in art has become a lot more mainstream.
That weird-ass shit of meditation, that's suddenly, like, kind of cool.
It's very cool, but art therapy, it's still a little
it's
bit
still on the
fringe.
Yeah,
sure. A lot more people are getting into it, and there's a lot of people who are professional practitioners now who might have come from psychology background or indeed from you know, meditation or other modalities. There's also people like me, I guess, who have had very limited formal training in their arts practice and are simply starting from a place of letting their art express their feelings.
Let's just turn our attention to the Royal Commission and what you've witnessed. I have no doubt that you've followed almost every breath of it fairly closely,
yes,
out of self-interest, understandably. What what are you getting out of it? Because, you know, some of that is about reliving other people's stories, which has got to be a trigger for you in some ways.
It's remarkable how, again, this is a bit like exposure therapy, which is one of the main therapies that people are often offered or talked about in looking at recovery from post-traumatic stress disorder. The idea that you would take hold of one traumatic memory or experience and with somebody in a professional setting expose yourself to that until your symptoms begin to ameliorate.
You've got to be making sure everything's in place, though.
Indeed. I guess that I really had no idea that exposing myself to the proceedings, to putting together my art exhibition and being open about being a survivor, were going to have on my recovery. In fact, you know, speaking with my psychologist where, you know, we're already some months down the road of what would be an otherwise traditional method of recovery therapy, where, as I say, we would take one experience from my past and work with that until symptoms ameliorated. My symptoms are less. It's not that hearing other people's experiences necessarily directly re-traumatizes me. I think once you begin...
Does it strengthen you in some way?
It can do, I think. And I think that it's a very individual experience. My experience has been that this process of watching the proceedings of the Royal Commission, participating in giving evidence, not in public hearings, but private sessions with the Commissioner and, you know, my own work with my art exhibition, it just chips away.
This might sound a little fucked up, but is there a kind of pleasure seeing Pal squirm?
Look, not for me anymore.
You know what I mean by that.
I do. And look, I think there's a place for that.
Yeah,
of course there is. For me, it's really, I'm focused very much when I'm watching those proceedings on getting an honest account of what occurred as far as is possible. Now, you know, you can tell.
Pal's honest account.
But you can tell, I think, from the questioning that comes from the extremely experienced counsel assisting the commission.
Not much gets past them.
Well, you see, they're working on the basis of documentation they have and they're following up, which may not in and of themselves anything of particular interest without the process of questioning and a public hearing. So really, they're not testing the waters. They've got real evidence there and they're looking for responses to that evidence that really helped illustrate what was going on. Now, I think, you know, I generally haven't focused on one person or another, but it's really interesting to me that the process of disagreeing to give evidence in person in Australia meant, you know, the Cardinal created a worldwide issue of his evidence.
That coverage of his testimony went global.
Yes.
I was late at night watching, as I do, Al Jazeera and BBC and all of that.
Yes.
It was on every station.
Yes. I mean, really, he's seen as the second or third most senior Catholic in the world now.
Yeah.
I mean, even coverage in Brazil, which is, of course, the largest Catholic nation, was remarkable. I mean, it was, they were also covering some of the proceedings live.
And yet, if he turned up here in Melbourne or Ballarat and gave his testimony, I doubt whether it would have got the coverage globally that it did.
Yes, so the disservice that he did himself was of great service to the rest of the community. And look, by the time he'd given those 4 days of evidence, it was quite clear that, if nothing else, he did nothing to question the culture of the day, even if that's the least that you place on it. And I do take that from an informed position. Even if that's the least that you take away from this, he had many opportunities to clarify that and didn't.
As a survivor yourself, what ultimately do you want to see come out of the Royal Commission? What is it that would in some way not only heal but mend, beyond heal, make it better, or is that possible?
Well, that's indeed the question, isn't it? Is it possible? It's going to be more possible for some than it's going to be for others. There will be people who, throughout this process, have their trauma relived, never get to the point of giving evidence to the commission, who still may never raise it with anybody before, you know, they pass away or die. I mean,
and yet there are so many that have taken their own lives.
There's still hundreds, if not thousands, of people on waiting lists to speak to the Commission. I guess I've got a lot of faith in the Commission's work. I think that what we're going to get out of the Commission is probably as much as we can expect out of a body like the Commission. And that's not to say that it's doing less than it can, but rather you know, you've always got processes that occur after something like the Commission finishes its work. But what I've seen of them and their work, in fact, I wouldn't have been inspired to be exhibiting my own art if it hadn't been for the encouragement of a staff member from the Commission.
So tell me about that.
Well, their counselling and support team are simply very supportive of your outlook.
See, we
and
don't,
what you need.
As an outsider, we don't understand what goes on as part of the process.
Yes.
We see, you know, the counsel assisting on the stand, and we see the person giving the testimony.
Yes.
But we don't see what goes on behind the scenes. So tell us a bit about that process.
Yeah. Well, I can speak from my perspective. I didn't give evidence in a public hearing. Certainly there's no, at this point, point in the future where I'm likely to either. That can change. So my contact started in early 2014 when I wrote an email to the person who handles professional standards in the diocese in which the perpetrator was in when they were living. And I CC'd or pretty well sent the same message to the Commission. Now, it took until May 2015, so about a year and a quarter before my place on the waiting list came up and I was able to give evidence directly to one of the commissioners in a private session. And I won't go into that private session much. They are subject to, you know,
but
I guess
you sat down one-on-one with one of the appointed legal representatives.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And a staff member who was taking copious notes. And we went through the statement I prepared as a part of the process of the previous year and a bit, which I'd done so with the support of No More Legal Services, a community legal centre, that particular one in Perth, because that's where the abuse occurred. Again, very supportive staff there who gently take you through the process, who kind of, you know when enough of a conversation's taken place to finish it and schedule in another time. We really are talking about very well-trained people who really guided my journey through this. I also, through my general practitioner, got referral through what's then the Medicare allowance to see psychologists.
Because unlike the generalist conversation that we're having here tonight,
yes,
the conversation I imagine you have with the Commission has to be high in detail and very graphic.
Relatively so. It's really, I guess, to also put a face to the statement that the Commission has already received, to also put that into context with other statements they've received about the same perhaps parish or individual.
Joining dots.
It is a kind of a joining dots experience, but it's very much they're very interested in your personal experience and what's occurred for you since.
And there's a counselling element around that.
Yeah, there's services you can access directly from the Commission. I didn't access services directly.
You had your own private ones.
I saw a psychologist. Those were sessions bulk billed through Medicare.
In that regard, would you say that the way it is handling itself from a survivor's perspective, that the Commission is bang on?
Yeah, from my experience, certainly. And look, I am aware that not everybody's it's a long time to wait, for example. Again, I had expectations that it was going to take a long time. The Commission hadn't long started when I contacted them. They were already advising the public that they already had long waiting lists. So none of that worried me, but look, it might have worried people, and I certainly have heard of other people that's concerned.
I know when the Royal Commission was first announced, it was given a time, but also told, we were all told, that it could go a lot longer, and it has.
Yes.
Do we have a deliverable date that you know of?
Well, at the moment, funding is guaranteed till the end of 2017. But suffice to say, I won't quote the commissioner that I was in a session with, but I was given an undertaking, really, that the commission was going to request whatever resources it sees fit and yes. that are required for it to continue its work if it's not completed by 2017. So, these sorts of things could actually go on for a very long time. Whether or not they've got everything they need by then, we'll see.
I doubt whether any Prime Minister, whomever that may be at the time, would deny the Commission the funding they needed.
You'd have to, A, think that they were more intelligent than that, and B, obviously the backlash in the public would be enormous if that was the case.
Jonathan Goodfellow, I turn my attention to Ireland and I see apart from the horrendous things that have done to those who were abused, it's the grandmothers and the mothers who've devoted their lives to the church out of good faith, who have literally had their worlds upended. And it's a periphery abuse, particularly of faith and their foundation. That upsets me too, because these are families and good women and good men who have done good things.
Yes.
And to see their life's devotion to anything shattered to the extent that it is.
Yes.
That's obnoxious.
And I think, again, the thing here is to look toward examples in those communities of people who are doing things differently. And there are groups of, for example, mothers, Catholic mothers in Melbourne, who came together and who went to the proceedings in Ballarat simply out of no other inclination than to show their support for victim survivors. So I think, there are these amazing examples, even within the faith communities, that... I'm not a person of any institutionalized religion. I don't carry faith in that sense. But some of the people who've stood up throughout the years and who are standing up now, I guess in some senses for them it's about holding on to their faith and remolding, reshaping themselves and even their faith to some degree to fit in with this new narrative, this new reality that we have. But I really take my hat off to those that have said, I'm a good Catholic person, or I'm a good Anglican person, or I'm a good whatever denomination or whatever. In fact, we've had even people saying, I'm the good sister of a pedophile dancing teacher, trying to come to terms with what it was that what role they played. And I think that even the best of Catholics would be asking themselves, or Anglicans,
what could I have done?
Were the things going on in my diocese and I didn't know about them? And I think that, the impact we're seeing on the community in Ballarat is an example, one that's easy to look at from the outside, to look at what's going on there. But it's one's being repeated across the country and across the world in all sorts of religious faiths at the moment.
I imagine you have good days and bad.
Yeah. I do. I'm, really, I guess, on something of a steadier path now. That has been in and of itself a stressful process.
Sure.
To simply feel that you're back at some level of control. And certainly, we don't know what the future holds for us, but I'm doing my darndest to express myself as I go along that journey.
We are with Jonathan Goodfellow. He is recounting some of the tales of his survival journey as a victim of child sexual abuse. And if any of the conversation that we have been talking about tonight has troubled you and you want to talk to someone, call Lifeline 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14. Or you can contact Switchboard from 3 p.m. till 12 midnight, 7 days a week. Their number is 1800 184 527. That's 1800 184 527. You are with Dean Beck on Hide and Seek.
At Joy 94.9, there are approximately 300 volunteers bringing you over 75 shows, 24 hours per day, 7 days a week. That's a lot of facts and figures to take in, but here's one more number for you to think about. 1-300-569-949. That's the number to call to talk to the Joy sales team about becoming a Joy sponsor. One phone call can get your business on air and online, reaching thousands of Joy listeners at a price you can afford. 1-300-JOY-949. That's 1-300-569-949.
Joy 94.9.
Hi, this is Dan Savage, and you're listening to Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9.
Thank you very much, Dan. Dean Beck with you on Hide and Seek. My guest is Jonathan Goodfellow. We've been talking about his survival as a victim of child sex abuse, and we've touched on how his photography and art has been helping him get through that process. Jonathan, you are a former dancer, are an artist and a photographer. You're having an exhibition coming up soon.
Yes.
Tell us about your art. Okay. What is your art?
This is the upbeat part of the conversation.
This is the good stuff.
You're not going to see any of my art with, you know, reminders of my sexual abuse.
Right.
Essentially, my art is...
It's your escape mechanism.
It's an escape. It tends to be fairly complex. Some people describe it as mesmerizing. All of my work is abstract.
And when we say abstract, listener, let me assure you, it's abstract.
It's very abstract. You might pick up, you know, little figurative messages in there, but there's nothing necessarily in there to give you those cues.
It's the direct opposite of photorealism.
Indeed. That's exactly right. But I do it with the camera.
Yeah,
and
right.
I do a lot of it in lens.
Yeah.
Or I'll use multiple exposures and... you know, place transparencies of works together.
Are you using traditional or digital methods?
Both.
Okay.
I'm sometimes even using layers of my own drawing and painting as well.
Right.
But everything ends up in a digital format by the end of the process. Some people call me an analog digital artist, which is to say that I'm several steps removed from the digital.
I think it is a reference to your age, actually.
Yeah,
and I'm probably around the same age.
But then I wouldn't want to be a single digit on the show, quite frankly. No. But yeah, in the sense that I might create animations, I might display those on really fine LED screens. I might then take stills from those animated works. So you've already got two or three processes involved. So by the time you get to a final image, for me, I'm looking for a lot of complexity in the image. I've got a lot of images that are very simple, but you're never going to see, for example, I've got a series which I'm finishing up at the moment called Flowers and Vases. For anybody who's familiar with Robert Mapplethorpe's work, it's a series in memoriam to the brilliant photographer, one that removes
Iris Vulva.
One that removes the two beautiful things in those works of his flowers, that is the flowers and the vases. Mm. I just happen to have come across in the last few 2-3 years some amazing vases.
Oh wow!
And I've had the joy and pleasure of capturing those in an abstract way, and I guess the issue here is these are the vessels, the final vessels that those flowers are ever going to be held in. They're kind of important in a way that I think we undervalue them. But then,
wow, that's profound.
It is, and it kind of does touch on trauma and death and memory and all sorts of issues
and tossed
there
in the rubbish heap thereafter.
And of course, it's really a direct metaphor to Robert's death from AIDS-related causes in 1989, taken from us far too early, and at the height, you'd have to say, of his career. The flowers are the other beauty, but rather than capturing them, you know, half-cocked, ready for death in a vase, I've actually looked at those in their real scenarios. So, for example, I came across an amazing, you can call it a vase, I guess, but it was actually a fish tank in a very open-lit apartment in the middle with lilies, water lilies, craning up towards the surface. So I took one of the photos that I will be exhibited in the show is of those craning water lilies. So very, very fortunate to have caught them like that.
You never
really
get to see one of
them not to be in a vase.
Well, you don't get to see water lilies, what's beneath the surface.
Yeah, that's right. And the wonderful thing about them too is that they're in a house, they're in somebody's home. So they literally are the flowers on display. And the colours that are coming through from the sky are all reflected in the flowers, and indeed they look somewhat different and abstract to how they would if they were in a natural environment.
How many pieces will be on exhibit at your show?
Oh, gee, you're asking me for details now. A few dozen, I would say, at this point in time. I'm really touching on my whole career. from the late 80s when I worked as a commercial photographer. I studied for a time. I indeed was working on some of the earliest safe sex campaign imagery. I'll be hopefully showing some of those works. It is a community arts centre, but nonetheless.
There's a bit of censorship going on, isn't there?
Well, I wouldn't say censorship, but there's some expectations I need to meet. But come along and see the show. I mean, the other thing is the catalogue's going to have all the works from all of the various series that are going to be presented in the show.
You're not done yet. This isn't your retrospective.
No, it's kind of, this is where I'm up to now. And it is my first solo show. I have exhibited before in groups, but it is my first solo show. So, you know, that's also part of the reason for sharing my narrative. It's really this narrative that's brought me back to being a full-time practicing artist.
You've also put the call out for people to help you get this exhibition up and running, and there's a crowdfunding campaign associated with that. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So we started crowdfunding about 6 weeks ago. I've got a team of people helping me. Joel Murray, I think a good friend of yours, and out there community member, and a couple of other people, Arabella Douglas, a Sydney woman, and Ebony Seckham, another Sydney woman, and Ilya Chidzis from the north coast of New South Wales, are helping me promote everything, put together all of the materials, getting people in their networks to contribute where they can. And the call is still out there. We have a campaign where you can make a 100% tax deductible donation to the Australian Cultural Fund. If you just go onto the Australian Cultural Fund site and search for A Survivor's Journey to Abstraction, or even my name, Jonathan Goodfellow, JonathAthon, and Goodfellow as it sounds, good and fellow one word, you'll find that campaign. So anything you donate towards that campaign is 100% tax deductible. We've also got a rewards campaign. So if you want to pre-purchase artworks, or you just want to have a look at some of my art, you can go to the Generosity platform, which is the not-for-profit Indiegogo platform at generosity.com, and again just search for A Survivor's Journey to Abstraction and you'll come across all of the details to either buy a work, make a donation. There's a whole range of things we've got available there, from greeting cards to calendars to, as I say, buying artworks ahead of time. They're about 40% discount.
There you go.
So
bargain.
They are a bargain, and they'll be on sale there through the Generosity site for the whole of the exhibition period. So, you know, we're really keen to make the whole show a success and not leave me in debt for the next few
that
years.
That would be nice
help
too.
Ourselves, yes.
Alternatively, get yourself along to the opening of Jonathan Goodfellow's exhibition titled A Survivor's Journey to Abstraction. It is on Thursday, the 21st of April, at the Box Hill Community Arts Centre. There'll be details on our podcast page for Hide and Seek. It is a fundraiser for the Australian Sex Party. Fiona Patton will be speaking at the event. And go to Facebook for more
details. It's a fundraiser for Living Positive Victoria.
Oh, that's right.
Yes, my apologies.
A fundraiser for Living Positive Victoria, not the sex party.
But
Fiona Patton will speak at it to help raise funds for Living Positive Victoria. Jonathan Goodfellow, good luck with the opening and good luck with the exhibition. And once again, Facebook for A Survivor's Journey will have more, as will our website at Hide and Seek. Thank you very much for joining
us
on the show tonight.
It's been great to chat with you, Dean. Thanks so very much.
My absolute pleasure. I'll be back to wish you all a very good night right after this. You are on Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
Well, a very, very, very big thank you to everyone who has been listening tonight and who has emailed in and shared your thoughts on tonight's conversation. Not an easy one to have, but very, very honoured to have had Jonathan Goodfellow share his story with us tonight. Big thank you to Jonathan. Thank you to you. Thank you to David, who does our podcasting, which you will find at joy.org.au/hide-and-seek. You'll probably find it on iTunes and Stitcher as well. My name is Dean Beck. You can follow me on Twitter, or you can get in contact with us by heading to our webpage on Joy's website and clicking on all of the social media engagements. We will catch you again next week on this fine show. But until then, you keep well. Take care. Bye for now.
You can subscribe to Hide and Seek's podcast for free. Visit joy.org.au/hideandseek for more information. Suggest a topic, a guest, or provide feedback. Email hideandseek@joy.org.au.
Hide and seek.
Hide and seek.
Hide and seek.
Hide and seek.
Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.